She's to sick bay. The doctor should look at it as soon as possible.
It is the way in which we propagate our species. Please demonstrate how this is accomplished.
So, what's next?
Hi, and welcome to Casual Trek, a Star Trek recap and ranking podcast brought to you by Nerd and Ty and their good friends, the terrorist group The Circle. My name is Charlie Heath H. Noon. Here are my Screen Tweaks fan.
And hi, I'm Mars Reed Lobato, a science fiction writer and a fan of that other 1993 space opera TV show, which dealt up with the ups and downs of religious-based space politics, Mobile Suit Victory Gundam. Although that show had far more intense atmospheric space battles and far less touching reunions between fathers and sons. It would have been really easy for me to say Babylon 5, though, that other mid-90s space opera space station-based TV show. I also wanted on record that I'm also a fan of Twin Peaks, but Charlie beat me to it, and apparently we can't have the same fandom per show.
Yeah, we've not really made a formal thing of that, and yet I was still quite proud of going, how deliciously wicked, Charlie, you can beat him to Twin Peaks. Part of me was thinking you'll just do Twin Peaks Return.
Oh, I should have done that.
That's right. Well, each episode we watch stories from three different Star Trek shows and rank them on our big list of best to worst. But this time we're doing something slightly different. We're looking at the Homecoming Trilogy, the first ever Star Trek three-parter. This came from DS9 and I have no memory of this at all, although I'm pretty sure I saw some of, like, at least the first part of Star Trek DS9 Season 2. So yeah, it's going to be one story, just over three episodes, which is exciting. And yeah, before we go on though, Miles, what non-Star Trek thing have you been enjoying since we last spoke?
Well, I have to admit that this one I feel is kind of cheating, because it is sort of Star Trek adjacent. Rihanna and I are currently watching the new season 19 of Taskmaster, which of course stars everyone's favorite Prince Vantis, Sweet Prince Vantis, if you're a fan of Hello from Magic Tavern, which my wife Rihanna definitely is, or, you know, Jankum Pog from Star Trek Prodigy, the character Charlie most resembles in real life, who was of course played by Jason Mantzoukas!
Oh god, Vazooks, yes! Yeah, he's been a joy. I love his work in most things. He is a lunatic in most roles he plays, but listening to him on How Did This Get Made, and he was a recurring guest star on the Gilmore Guys podcast, because he's that much of a fan of Gilmore Girls, I realised, oh yeah, he would be perfect for this. Like, he's not just going to be big, but yeah, he's certainly weird with it. I kind of wanted him, after the first episode, to bring out more and more worrying tools with every single episode. But sadly, so far, that doesn't seem to have been the thing.
I mean, God, like, we just watched, we're keeping up on it. So the one task with the cushions, where he has a perfect plan and sabotages himself, my heart did break.
Oh, God. So many contestants, you get that kind of thing of, like, oh, my God, yeah, they've kind of got a great plan, and then they fuck it up partway through, change their mind, get distracted. Like, Jason does seem like the kind of person that if someone crinkled some paper near him or something, the plan would go.
So, be honest, is Jason Mantzoukas the Star Trek actor you would want to meet for a pint the most?
Oh, God. Probably. I don't know. That's difficult, because a lot of them feel like they'd be a lot of fun, you know? Cole Meany definitely has stories and beyond just Star Trek.
I mean, I would love to meet LeVar Burton.
Yes. Yeah, he seems delightful.
I mean, I would love to meet Jonathan Frakes.
Yeah.
I would feel intimidated by Patrick Stewart.
Yeah, I don't think I could actually speak to him. I have met Dwight Schultz, and he was lovely, but also rushed off his feet. I don't know, there are too many where you'd go like, actually, there'd be a decent hang.
Yeah.
Like, when I was listening to Shuttlepod, the guys from that that play Reed and Trip were just nice. They're a bit lovey about everything, but, you know, that's fine. Bottle of wine.
That's actors for you.
Exactly. Yeah, it did prove that pretty much every Star Trek actor has a book and probably a band.
Like, the person I would most love to meet for a pint for an hour, non-Star Trek-wise, would be Hideo Kojima.
Oh my god. Yeah, that'd be weird.
Like, or alternatively, I would love to just hang for an hour with George Lucas. I wouldn't even want to talk about Star Wars. In fact, I would make it a thing not to bring up Star Wars. I would just want to ask him, like, what he thinks about books that he has read. Or, like, other films. I would just want to go, George, have you seen The Big Lebowski? And what do you think of it? Because I really want to imagine that George Lucas has opinions about The Big Lebowski.
Who knows? Like, maybe, I don't know, sometimes he feels like a much more done-up version of the dude. With the kind of late career, I'm just going to sit down. That's it. You know? Whenever people take photos of him, it is just like, yeah, he's there, just sat in a cafe or something. It's like, good, live your best life.
Good for you, George, you've earned it.
Yes. Yeah, aside from Jason Mantzoukas, I've enjoyed pretty much all the cast this time. It seems like one of those series where there is no clear this person is good at something. Sometimes you get ones where one person is very competitive and very good, and everyone else is lagging behind. This feels like one of those ones where everyone is terrible, and it's brilliant.
I mean, we just finished, because we're also slowly watching. Actually, no. We are watching the show pretty quickly, because we discovered it early last year, and we just finished season 14, which had John Kearns.
Oh, who God.
Be the most, the human personification of just Charlie Brown energy.
Oh, God. He is terrible. He is so brilliantly awful at absolutely everything.
Because I swear, like, nearly every episode, it always feels like there's a moment when he's actively contemplating throwing himself off a bridge.
Yeah. There are definitely moments. Like, I loved Nish Kumar, as far as people that have no ability or competence in this. And it's like, I've heard you talk about politics. You are smart, but fucking hell. Like, you are not competent at all here.
I think John Kearns, you know, matches Joe Thomas from season 8.
Oh.
In terms of, you know, oh my god, you know that you are the loser in this equation and you're just going to go with it.
I love Joe Thomas so much. That was such a good fun series of it.
I was kind of sad that they didn't bring up more of the fact that Joe and Greg have a history from the Inbetweeners. I was hoping for kind of more of that. But, you know, the song where Joe writes a song about the horrific murder of Alex Horn being a good thing in the eyes of God was a standout moment.
Oh, God, yeah.
But this is not a Taskmaster podcast. They have their own podcast for that, as far as I've heard. Charlie, what non-Star Trek thing have you been enjoying?
Oh, my God.
And I also built a bookshelf.
Oh, nice.
A rare moment of competent adulting from me.
That's good. Yeah, once I get a wall light removed from my bedroom, I need to get some bookshelves put in. But I know what I'm like, so I'm going to hire someone instead. That way they will stay up. But yes, I have been enjoying The Blueprints on the PlayStation. It's a weird game. It's good fun, though. It's kind of a room drafting game where you're, like, it's roguelite in that you do runs of it and each day you're laying down tiles, kind of trail at a house on the hill looking tiles of different rooms onto a map, and you walk around them in first person. And you're this kid who is trying to get to room 46 of a 45 room building. So you need to figure out how to do that. It's one of those games where I've had to dedicate a notepad to it, because some of the clues and some of the puzzles are the kind that you end up kind of using some graph paper and charting things out and figuring out ciphers and stuff like that. So like Cyberpunk, it's a game Emma and I have both been doing. She hit room 46 before I did, and it's not over. It's a weird game, and if you like a kind of puzzly wandering game, like I tend to have a podcast on and just merrily traipse around the rooms, adding little scribbled notes and drawing patterns for things that I've found in there. So yeah, it's good fun, definitely. And the kind of thing that I'm having to be very guarded about what I say, because I don't want to spoil the fun of anyone that's playing it. So, on to our trilogy. First up, we have part one, which was Star Trek DS9 Season 2 Episode 1, titled Homecoming. This aired on the 26th of September 1993. Teleplay by Ira Stephen Baer. Story by Jerry Taylor and Ira Stephen Baer. Directed by Winrich Colby. The UK number one hit at time of release was DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince with Boom Shake the Room. And the US had Mariah Carey with Dream Lover. Dream Lover, when it started, it sounded like a Mariah Carey that I'd heard, but I did not remember this one at all.
Boom, shake, shake, shake the room. Boom, shake, shake, shake the room. Boom, shake, shake, shake the room. Tick, 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 boom. I don't think I've heard the song in 20 years.
No. Yeah, it would have been in the mid-aughts at a 90s party that I was at Sussex University that I last heard this.
Oh, man. Remember when Will Smith did music?
Yeah. I was like, yeah, okay.
Yeah, I still think that, you know, Will Smith missed a trick by not doing tie-in raps to all his blockbuster movies. Because I really want to have seen the rap song that would have covered After Earth.
Yeah. Yeah, or that one where he's an insurance guy and has fucked a bunch of people over and is trying to kind of make up for that.
Oh, I Am Legend. That one would have had a, if that had been made in the 90s, that would have had a kick-ass rap tie-in song.
Oh, that would have been so good. Yeah, you could have had a dance number with weird vampire monsters. Yeah, we've been robbed. Oh, well. But yeah, it's both of these, which we will be revisiting, feel like some of the most 1993 music that we've heard on this.
Like, I think the Mariah Carey song is the US number one for all three episodes.
Oh, it is. It is. We at least get a change at one point, but, you know, spoilers for later. Yeah. Yeah. And you're spoiling us by recapping the first part of this three-part saga, Homecoming. So you've got 5 minutes until the circle sprays some offensive logos on your, guess what? On your wall? On the Smash Brothers poster? Probably on the Smash Brothers poster. Starting now.
Just another day at Quark's. Odo is harassing Quark about a ship smuggling in faulty tech to Bajor. To Odo's confusion, Quark was utterly right. There's a catch, right? No catch. Quark is just following the 77th rule of acquisition. Every so often, declare peace. It confuses the hell out of your enemy. Meeting with an acquaintance, Quark is given a Bajoran earring, which came from Cardassian space on the planet Cardassia 4. Quark gifts the earring to Kira, who is not pleased that Quark came to her quarters, although when she sees the necklace, She storms off to find Sisko, leaving Quark in her quarters. Not a good idea. He's probably going to be rolling around in her underwear drawer. Jake, meanwhile, comes to Sisko. Hey, he asked that Bajoran girl out and she said yes! And he wants advice from his dad. Unfortunately, Sisko isn't very helpful, especially when Kira interrupts their little father-son bonding. Kira wants to borrow a runabout to rescue a Bajoran POW from Cardassian space. The earring belongs to Lee Nalis, Bajor's greatest resistance leader during the Cardassian occupation. She already got turned down by the Bajoran government and knows that she wants help from Sisko. Lee could unite Bajor as both religious and political infighting is spreading throughout the planet. Sisko is called to the Habitat Ring, where he sees graffiti belonging to a Bajoran nationalist group calling themselves the Circle, who believe that Bajor is for Bajorans only. Telling Odo to increase security, Sisko talks to Dax about how tough their mission to kind of bring Bajor into the Federation is becoming and wants advice from her. Dax tells Sisko to give Kira the runabout. If the Cardassians have a problem with them breaking out Lee, then they did promise that they had released all POWs. Sisko gives Kira the runabout with an extra Miles O'Brien as assistance. Kira is reluctant to have O'Brien help, but Sisko admits that he needs Lee Nalis back just as much as she does. Besides, O'Brien's seen how the Cardassians treat their prisoners, and no one deserves that. Kira and O'Brien sneak onto Cardassia 4 using the old, hey, we got that important ship for the prison warden, and he's going to be pissed if it's late. And they manage to fudge their convince role. And they discovered that there's a dozen Bajoran prisoners actually on there, but they're going to have to do the mission on foot. They can't beam out enough people with the transporter. Cardassia 4 is a Doctor Who planet. It's a gravel pit. Kira disguises herself as a sex worker to sneak in with O'Brien as her pimp. They're lucky the horny, stupid guard is on duty and get into the camp, and there's a good old-fashioned prison breakout. After a bunch of the prisoners stay behind to buy time, Kira and O'Brien save the rest, including Lee Nalis, but Kira is forced to leave but a few behind or else risk capture by Cardassian warships. Quickly arriving back on DS9, oh shit, Gul Dukat is on the phone, and he's apologizing for there still being Cardassian POWs, and any left behind were sent home right now. Both Sisko and Kira don't trust Dukat worth a damn, but hey, they'll take the win. Meanwhile, in Medbay, Bashir is gushing over Lee Nalis's war history, but Lee doesn't want to talk about his war stories. Minister Jaro, arrives to retrieve Lee, but chastises Kira for risking war with Cardassia. As a politician, though, as a private citizen, he thanks Kira, but next time she pulls a stunt like this, they'll want her badge and her gun. At the Replimat, a crowd wants Lee to make a speech. Lee just wants a moment's bloody peace and quiet. Last night he was a slave, now he's a war hero. He asks Sisko what Bajor was like. Sisko tells Lee the truth. Bajor lacked strong leadership, and Lee realizes what Kira wanted him for, and nopes out immediately. Wanted to sneak away on a ship and get as far away from the situation as possible. As Quark, meanwhile, is cheating Rom out of his fair wages, he is attacked by three robed masked figures who hold him down and brand his forehead with the mark of the Circle. Lee Nalis nopes out, trying to stow in a random freighter. He doesn't want to be a political figurehead. Sisko and Lee talk. Lee telling Sisko about a time during the occupation that his legendary status that he once killed this badass Cardassian and definitely has done a sex was actually a moment where he actually stumbled.
Oh, time up. Oh dear, Oli Nalis and your boasting ways. Right. Okay, let's start the stopwatch.
Lee tells Sisko about a time during the occupation where he was meant to have killed this legendary Cardassian war criminal, but actually he just stumbled on the guy, unarmed, bathing, in his underwear, and in the fight just shot him, and it was blown out of all proportions to make him into the symbol, not a man. Make him into the most badass Bajoran war hero, who has definitely done a sex. Sisko tells him that they need a symbol, not a man, who has definitely done a sex, and Lee could provide that. But, says Lee, based on a lie, no. Based on a legend, says Sisko. The next day, Minister Richard Nixon and Lee arrives. Lee has been given the brand new rank of Navark. Oh, and he's been made the Bajoran liaison to Deep Space Nine. Oh, and Kira's been sent back to Bajor. Oh, and it's to be continued. Oh, and Jake's date totally broke it off with him because her dad doesn't want her dating a non-Bajoran, even though his father's the emissary. But still, a better dating track record than Wesley Crusher.
Oh, yeah, I mean, sad but true, dating-wise. Yeah, that's 1 minute and 11 over. So, yeah, that was quite a bit of a part one. I didn't think that it would go beyond the prison break at first, that it would be mainly that. But yeah, they got that over quite nice and quickly.
Yeah. I mean, it's sometimes kind of weird to see Star Trek, like, not filming on, like, a soundscape. So, and it was very fun to see them basically filming what clearly looks like a gravel quarry.
It's, yes.
It's like, yeah. I did almost expect to see Tom Baker and Liz Sladen just come out behind a mountain, realize they're in Star Trek, go, oh shit, and then turn around and just kind of hide back behind the mountain.
Yeah, so I gather this was originally going to be a TNG plot, and it feels like it really couldn't have been. I don't know how early in the process it was, but yeah, having some random Bajoran woman instead of Kira, where this feels very, very much a Kira story.
Wouldn't that have been Ro at this point in the show? I mean,
maybe. It's nice seeing a bit of a character focus for Kira here. And yeah, I don't know. I know a lot of the Bajoran nonsense episodes I kind of wrote off a bit originally, but yeah, this is some all right Bajoran nonsense. And of course, one thing that wasn't mentioned in the recap, but Richard Boehmer, our old Ben Horn himself, is Lee Nallis. And my word, the acting. Any time that he's on, even though he is a Bajoran prisoner, even though he's an extremely reluctant and sometimes just moody escapee, it's like, yes, yes, give us the acting, Richard.
For a moment, I got mistaken over which Twin Peaks actor was in this, and I was like, he doesn't look like Ray White. Oh, wait, no. I am very sad that at no point does Lee Nallis get really excited about a sandwich.
Yeah, that would have been great. Oh, I'm out of prison. Oh my god, I'm just gonna be all excited over this giant sandwich.
Just starts dancing on the table of the Replimat.
That'd be great. Yeah, maybe dancing on the table at Quark's bar or something.
In a different episode, a much different toned episode of DS9. Yeah, I do like whenever we get to see Kira and O'Brien kind of get teamed up.
Well, yeah, given both of their history with Cardassians, I admit that was one of those moments where I often forget about that. And then when O'Brien was being sent on, I was like, oh, yeah, of course. So, yeah, it was nice seeing O'Brien be very much like, no, I'm on your side with this. Like, you're leading, yeah. But fucking like, Card is.
Like, O'Brien is like the one character who I think both he and Kira definitely feel like they're more like like working class members of the team, unlike, you know, Dax, who is very much a very proper scientist, and Bashir, who is still in Pratt mode.
Yes. Yeah, he is a bit.
I do need to make a slight digression. I did read that DS9 novel with the Horta, which I mentioned last episode, and a lot of fun. Also deals with Kira coming across a Cardassian prison filled with Bajoran POWs from the occupation, and a lengthy prison break. Although this time, she brings Bashir along, and Bashir is still in Pratt mode. At one point, he thinks Kira has a crush on him, which thankfully goes nowhere.
Yeah.
But, you know, as they're trying to rescue the Horta, they also have to rescue a bunch of Bajoran POWs and get the fuck out. And also, Odo turns into a Horta to kind of confuse the Horta babies, which are devouring Deep Space Nine, and quite enjoys just kind of hanging out as a Horta.
Okay. So does his touch burn when he turns into one?
I can't remember. I don't think he can.
Oh, okay. And yeah, that feels like the sort of thing that if he discovered the ability to do, then he'd do it all the time, you know, like in X-Men, when Mystique's suddenly able to grow like wings or claws that actually work.
You know, he would be using it to troll Quark all the time. Just have like, you just kind of burst into the bar dressed, you know, disguised as a halter and scares everyone away.
Anytime he gets bored. Yes. Yeah, apparently this set actually made Colm and Nanar ill when they were performing on it, but the production loved it enough. They were like, no, we're going back. It was, Soledad Canyon.
Did they say what?
I think it was the heat. Okay. Like, it's supposed to be a fairly inhospitable place anyway.
Because like, when you hear about that, it's kind of worrying because like the amount of like bombs which were set off with nuclear testing in New Mexico, which of course would then use this location filming for Westerns, and you just have this long litany of Western actors who basically died of cancer they got from performing in these areas where just like there was just this random just radiation lying around.
Jesus. Yeah, that sounds rough.
Do you think in real life prison guards are told, look, if a lady is really into you, just don't do anything?
Yeah, I guess maybe the guy in charge was like, look, I am going to have whores coming through at some point. It's just going to happen. So if it does, feel free to do your due diligence, but, you know, don't be too surprised.
Every third Tuesday, it's sex worker o'clock at Con Cardassia 4.
Exactly, yeah. Maybe it was like, oh, she's off schedule.
She's early.
Yeah.
Sisko doesn't get much to do in this one, but it is always kind of, well, okay, it's always nice to see, like, scenes between Jake and Sisko.
Yes, yeah, it is like, I don't know, the main parenting that we've seen has been, what, Bev and Wesley, and Wesley's mostly independent.
Yeah.
And that, and, yeah, Worf failing to parent Alexander. So, yeah, it's nice seeing these two actually kind of getting on with a level of independence and respect that isn't like, yeah, isn't like the others so much.
No.
Ben trying to be all like, yeah, I can help with those pickup lines. It's like, no, I'm good. I'm done already. It's fine. So, oh, okay. Fine. Oh. Yeah, that was nice to see. I always forget when it is that Sisko gets his beard, because I knew it wasn't season one. I thought it was season two at some point, but maybe not.
I think he gets the beard midway through season three.
Okay.
And then with season four, it opens literally with him having the shaved head. I don't know. I admit I kind of like the much more younger Sisko when he has the hair and no beard, because I don't know, because when he hits like it's you know, Riker grows a beard, it's like he grows up, and when Sisko grows a beard and shaves his head, it's like, oh man, this guy's not going to have a very good day for the next 4 years.
Yeah, this guy's going to have to mean business every time that he's doing anything.
Yeah,
he won't have fun on the station. He will get shit done instead.
And it's a shame because Avery Brooks has a fantastic smile.
Yes. Yeah, he does, definitely. Yeah. Oh, one thing that I didn't notice, but you put in the notes here. Grappler Zorn's back.
Yup.
Wow. Oh, yeah, briefly. And I think I looked at his cast kind of credits, and we have seen all three things in Star Trek that he has been in.
And then I end up doing some further research and discovered that this guy has quite the varied like career. He's Duke in the original G.I. Joe cartoon.
Oh.
A cartoon I have never seen, but I only know of pop culture osmosis, because in the G.I. Joe movie, they were going to kill Duke as a cynical way to advertise new toys, but the Transformers movie was doing the same thing. That came out first. An entire generation, yours truly included, was traumatized by the death of Optimus Prime.
Oh, yeah.
So they hurriedly rewrote the scene where Duke dies from literally being graphically stabbed in the gut by a spear with blood and everything. They edit it to, oh, Duke's fallen into a coma, as you're known to do when you're bleeding out from a gut wound.
Yeah.
And then they hurriedly dub in at the end a voiceover going, oh, and Duke's all right. But instead, it's just like, oh, we're just going to write out your main character for the second half of the movie.
I think I saw maybe a couple of episodes round at a friend's of the G.I. Joe cartoon. Mostly, I remember it because the action figures were the same size as Star Wars ones. So my brother and I used, like, knives and Warhammer paints to turn both of them into our own characters.
Of course.
Of course.
Of course.
Yeah. Yes, thus devaluing all of them.
Good.
Yeah, I guess one final thing of note here as well is there is an uncredited main actor here, which, as you said, was Skeletor himself, a.k.a. Perry White from Superman Returns, a.k.a. Arlington Stewart from The Box, or a.k.a. John Adams from The American Woman, Portraits of Courage. It's Frank Langella.
Langella.
Frank Langella, who, has a very fun performance here.
Yeah, he is one of those actors who, when you see him on screen, you're like, he's the villain.
Yeah, there's no way he's not.
He's like Brad Dourif, he's the villain. Like, you know, whenever you see Brad Dourif, you're not going to think, oh, now we're going to get, like, a sensitive, romantic soul of a poet. Like, no, he's going to try and kill someone. He's going to try and eat someone in about 2 minutes.
Yeah, it's going to make it weird, whatever he's doing.
Yeah.
But yeah, Frank Langella, he comes across very much as self-serving politician, you know, more that he wants credit for himself in this and the next one, but he's entertaining enough.
He is the best thing about the live-action Master of the Universe movie.
Yeah.
Where he chews the scenery beautifully as Skeletor.
Definitely, yeah. It makes it feel even sadder that the new Skeletor is going to be Jared Leto.
God.
Just gotta hope there's some kind of method acting disaster that results in him peeling his own face off or something.
I mean, we can hope. It's just like, it's like the new Tron film. It's like, oh yeah, we have Jared Leto. Why do you hate me?
Yeah.
I mean, okay, you've got Nine Inch Nails reuniting to do the soundtrack. I'm down for that. But I might just listen to the soundtrack and not have to deal with Jared Leto.
Yeah, at least he was sparingly used in Blade Runner 2047.
Yeah, 2049.
2049, that's it.
Like, I think he's in like three scenes and that's it. And like, God, Blade Runner 2049. Amazing film. Like, did you get a chance to see it in the cinema?
No, it was, God, when was it? I think it was round at my brother's at one point. We were both like, let's do it. Let's actually see this then. And we're like pleasantly surprised.
Like 2017. Like I went to see it like one Saturday morning and it looked amazing on a fucking big screen.
I'm sure. I think between Jared Leto and the fact that Harrison Ford sleepwalks through most films that he acts in these days, I decided to not bother seeing it until I heard enough good things.
Yeah, I mean, Harrison Ford is suitably awake.
Mm, yeah, surprisingly so.
And I enjoy the way the film manages to bring up but not solve the is Deckard secretly a replicant Ridley Scott BS. And I am firmly in the no, I don't think he is, but the film is just like, it doesn't matter.
No, and that's the best way of doing that, really.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't. But yeah, okay. So, we won't be ranking this yet, because all three of these episodes feel interconnected enough that we're going to rank them all as one big thing. So, yeah, we need to move on to the next one. And the next part is Star Trek Deep Space Nine Season 2, Episode 2, titled The Circle. This one aired on the 3rd of October 1993, written by Peter Allen Fields, directed by Corey Allen. The UK number one hit and the US number one hit remained unchanged with Boom, Shake the Room, and Dream Lover. And yeah, this time I'm going to be recapping.
All right. Now, Charlie, I have one question. Mm. Are you a dream lover or a one-track lover?
Wow. Probably a dream lover.
You're not a one-track lover? Down a two-way lane?
Wow.
Running fast down the highway must have been insane because the temperature's too high and traveling way too fast. And you feel our loving is too hot to last.
Wow. Okay. That's, yeah. Impressive. It is. And for people that, well, everyone but me basically couldn't see, but this was off the dome from Mars there.
Yep. You know, yet another of our very subtle Garth Marenghi's Dark Place shout outs in this podcast.
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
All right. And you must complete the circle in
Hooray.
5 minutes or less and engage.
So, Jarrow's upset that Sisko's not grateful for taking Kira off his hands, mainly as he doesn't get their dynamic. He reassures Sisko it's a promotion. Sisko reckons this is just political grandstanding from Jarrow to put himself in the middle of things. Jake calls up Sisko and summons him to their quarters. The Circle have sprayed their symbol on his door. Kira gets angrily packing, and Odo comes in, annoyed that she's actually obeying orders for once. Both of them reckon they were the force that tempered the other one's fire for each other. And then Dax arrives to return things she's borrowed probably years ago and never bothered to return until now. But she is vacantly there to congratulate Kira without having realised she does not want this. O'Brien joins a chaos and then Quark as well. It's all just delightful banter and chaos. Very talky movie kind of fun. And then Vedic Barol shows up to spoil all the fun and says violence has escalated on Bajor and he's been keeping an eye on Kira. Does she fancy coming to his monastery? Possible euphemism? Kira takes a turn around the ops. That was it. And Lee Nalis is already apologetic about taking Kira's place. Sisko says it's all right, he's going to get her back. We fast forward, and Kira is fixing stones in a monastery pond, feeling like she's wasting her potential as she is not a calm or artistic person. Barile suggests that she experiment with possibly being useless for a bit, you know, in a kind of zen, peaceful way. Then he shows her his orb, again, not a euphemism. This is the orb of prophecy and change, and Kira's vision shows Dax as a Vedic. Vedic, Wynn, and Jarrow, a big crowd, and Baral's there. He says they're here for Kira. Then she's naked, and then so's he. Oh yeah, it's one of those dreams. Odo has been busily looking into the circle. Bajor's escalating its military presence, and Quark reckons it's the end times, which is bad for business. He's somehow managed to get intel that the Kursari are taking arms to Bajor, and they're due to arrive in 36 hours. Odo strong-arms him into becoming his deputy. Sisko leaves a Bajor and puts Lee Nalis in charge. And a cargo bay has been vandalised by the Circle, so Nalis wants to put a curfew on. Kira doesn't tell Baral about her vision, not the horny parts at least, but he does mention she was in his, implying, yeah, probably also naked. Then they have a bit of a talk, and there's some distant gunfire. Oh dear! Just to make a situation worse, Vedic Wynn's shown up. Yeah. She gives some real Emily Gilmore vibes, judging Baral for showing off his orb to just anyone. Sisko meets a General Krim from the Bajoran Provisional Government and shares intel about the Kresari. He also wants Kira back, which Krim can't do. Dax helps Lee Nalis in lying for Kresari about why they can't leave the station, while O'Brien's there snooping around. Lee Nalis, however, breaks and buckles because he does not have the resolve that Kira does, lets him go, and they leave with a handy Odo on board, pretending to be a panel on a crate. It turns out the Cressians are working with the Cardassians. Oh, such cats! While all this happens, Sisko finds Kira in the monastery to make sure she still wants to leave. And when she realizes that she's not even noticed how close a coup is to happening, she definitely wants out of there. As soon as Sisko leaves, though, she's immediately kidnapped by the Circle. Sisko and Lee Nalis find out pretty quickly, actually, about the abduction. And Quark arrives with a rare moment of help. He knows where Kira is, thanks to a tracker on Odo. It's time for a mission, and Lee Nalis wants to come along too, which is where I assumed he would inevitably die. The rescue mission goes shockingly quickly. Like, Kira has a little bit of time with the Circle, and oh my god, it's Charo! He's evil! Yes, what a shock! He's in charge of a Circle. Curse his sudden yet inevitable betrayal! He gives the whole, we're not so different, you and I speech, but Kira's not having it, so she goes off for some torture instead. The rescue mission, boom, quick. Quick as the prison break in the previous episode.
Unfortunately, your recap is not as quick as the prison breakout in either episode. No.
Yeah. Oh, well. Okay. Oh, dear. Yes, it was nice being back in some caves again. Just reminded me of our previous episode.
Yep. Oh, God. When I was watching the episode last night, yesterday, the vision, and then where, like, when Kira is naked, and then when Beryl just kind of steps in from stage left, oh, so naked. It is the most, it's the most awkward. I had to get a screen cap and send it to you with the caption, hey, I'm naked too. This weird.
Right. Back on. Yeah. So yeah, Bashir finds Kira and gets shot, but the escape crew managed to pin a comm badge on her and everyone beams away. Jaro has a bit of a chat with Vedek Wynn about, you know, the way power's going to be once they're in charge. And Jaro sends some warships to DS9, telling them, get all non-Bajorans off the station in 7 hours. Clearing all that many people actually wouldn't take long. A couple of hours, maybe. But all their computers, all their stuff, their filing cabinets, shoes, anything not Bajoran being pried up and taken off would take days. So Sisko's going to use that option instead in order to be there when the Circle arrives. To be concluded. Ooh.
51 seconds.
Okay.
I feel there was one bit from your recap I feel I have to mention, is that Krim, fantastically naff science fiction name, by the way, when he's having his big scene with Sisko, he brings up a fact that Sisko gave him the information first instead of using it for leverage to get what he wants. Mm. And Sisko's like, nah, that's Sisko gives us we're with Starfleet, sir. We don't lie.
Yeah, we're with Starfleet. We don't extort. Not until I've shaved this head.
And gives us a nice bit where Krim kind of gets the measure of Sisko's character, which we'll kind of need for part three.
Yeah.
Krim definitely has a grudge, a respect for Sisko.
Yes, it didn't feel like it was too big or too core of a thing, which is why I made a note but skipped over it.
That's fair.
But yeah, this one, like, we got to see Bajor. I'm sure I remember it might just be the interior sets. I always remember being a little kind of reddy orange tinted in Bajor, where the outside, to be honest, the bit of stream with the rocks, that was vaguely reminiscent of up Queen's Parkway. You know,
Queen's Park.
Yeah, other side from the level.
Yeah.
This is some niche Brighton lore for people that don't know. There's a park called Queen's Park.
the rockery, or was that a different park?
Yeah, the rockery in it. Yeah, it gave that sort of vibe. Didn't look very monastery-ish, but no. You know. Bajorans are going to do things a bit differently, especially if they've got holy authority figures like Vedek Wynn.
Wynn.
She's so awful. I love her. She's just the absolute worst. And in that way where she doesn't need to be from the Cardassians, she doesn't need to be some kind of horrendous, terrifying space alien. She's horrendous and terrifying while being ostensibly on the same side as the people she's tormenting.
I have dealt with many Wynns at my time at Starbucks. They're definitely that passive aggressive, overly religious person who will say, "Oh, bless your heart," when you know when you say something, you know, that they disagree with. You know, she would unironically tweet thoughts and prayers hashtag.
Yeah, definitely. Yes, the kind of bless your heart said in the way which means die in a fire.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Yeah. She's definitely, you know, just asking questions about trans people and what exactly they do in bathrooms and all of that kind of thing. Like, Wynn is, just a terrible, terrible human being who is best in fiction. Really?
Yep. I could go on for so long about that, but I don't really want to. I like my podcast to be slightly disconnected from the horrors of my real life right now.
Fair. Yes. This is why, in my mind, it's that thing of okay, Vedek Wynn in an Emily Gilmore. She is just going to passive aggressively destroy everyone with words kind of thing, rather than a latter-day fan of J.K. Rowling.
Yeah. That said, if this were an HBO show, she and Jarrow would definitely be having their big kind of villain monologue while fucking.
Definitely. 100%. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, they make for a fun villain pair here. Yeah, I was surprised this wasn't her first appearance as well. Apparently she's in season one at one point.
She turns up at the very end of season one because it's the whole kind of... I remember that from my rewatch because she turns up and she's immediately awful. And she's immediately awful to Keiko, which it feels like that can't stand because the universe is horrible to Keiko.
Yeah, like you don't get to do that.
No.
It feels like, Keiko has some rough times, but... God, yeah, most other people on DS9 are fair game.
Yeah. Bits that, you know, I'm surprised just don't go on for longer in context of the three-parter is Quark being Odo's deputy.
Yeah, that is almost immediately abandoned. He has some fun with it, at least. You know, both being pressured and kind of press-ganged into it by Odo. Who's in that kind of, you're my deputy. It's like, no. It's like, yeah, or else. It's like, oh, fuck. Oh, he got me with that one.
Also, you forgot to mention that Odo has a friend. An actual... he has a friend!
It was so brief. I forgot until you mentioned Odo has a friend.
Friend! Bajoran friend!
Friend!
Oh, friend! Like, I guess he's like Odo's, like, mate on the beat. And he just phones up, is like, yeah, you know, it's going to shit down here. Just kind of, you know, watch your ass, man. In a kind of cop show kind of way.
Oh, God, yeah.
And it's like, Odo, you cracked a smile. You can do it.
Yeah, it does feel like you'd have to be just the shittest person. And Odo would be like, yeah, he's great, isn't he? It's like, oh, love him. And everyone's like, man, Odo, this guy's really toxic. Like, everyone's terrified of him. Like, he poked out the eye of a vendor somewhere. It's like, yeah, classic.
Classic that guy.
Yeah. Oh, God. Actually, yeah, this episode was one thing I completely forgot. This is the one where they have a terrible Chakotay that's not our usual terrible Chakotay. Like, there are no good Chakotays, apparently.
Not in the Star Trek universe.
No. I've just got on my notes here. Fucking hell, no one called Chakotay's any good, are they? It's like, yeah.
All right. Scenes which they definitely could not have done on TNG.
Mm.
The scene in Kira's quarters that she's packing up, and everyone's coming in, and it's all awkward. And I think like the writers are kind of getting what they can do in Deep Space Nine that they couldn't do in TNG, where everyone is perfect.
Yeah,
and I feel like, you know, it's. I would definitely bring this up in the third part, but like you can imagine these characters are friends, and it's because it's just like everyone's dropping by Kira's quarters, and you can get their character. Like Dax is here to return something. Bashir is just kind of like, hey, you know, good luck with everything. Odo's just there to bitch, but that's Odo. And Quark's like, party.
Yeah. It's apparently it was based on A Night at the Opera and was done as a one take scene, which is rare really for Trek, but there's frankly any directional ambition, especially from this era. It's lovely when it happens.
It is lovely when it's clear the actors just get a chance to like act. That's not all just slapped together in the edit.
Yeah. It did feel a bit like, right, Dax here, props go. Bashir, wait 5 seconds, then go as well. And just sparkle out there. Have some fun banter.
Yeah, and again, it's just like, you know, I feel like while the TNG, you know, crew are friends, it always feels much like we will have a drink in 10 forward and we will play poker. It never really, I think that one thing I do love about Deep Space Nine is that it does feel like a community. It does feel like a small town.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't get Picard cooking for folks.
No.
Really, compared to, like, Sisko and later on Pike as well, going, yeah, get a bunch of people around, have a cook. Picard is like, no, this is where I read my book.
I'm going to sit in my room and stare at the wall intensely and go, I wish they would invite me to poker. I wish they would invite me to poker. I wish they would invite me to poker.
And which, yeah, as it turns out, is the plot of the finale.
Like,
that was a delightful scene. And looking at the details about it, apparently it's the first time that Sisko's baseball appears. It's like, oh.
I think it turns up earlier. I think, I don't know. I thought he gets the baseball like early, like sometime in the season one episode.
God, I'm going to have to look it up now.
Because, like, the Sisko baseball usually ends up being, like, always gets treated as, like, a subtle plot point for Sisko's relation to Deep Space Nine.
Yeah. Then I've no idea why it was mentioned on Memory Alpha as that. It's apparently, it was in If Wishes Were Horses. And just looking at the one screen caption here at the top of that episode, I didn't remember there's an episode of DS9 with a leprechaun in it.
Oh, I've got to
put a pin in that for later.
No. It's Rumpelstiltskin. It was going to be a leprechaun, but Colm Meaney quite literally said, I'll quit.
I guess that's better. Yeah, maybe with, was it, there was an Alice in Wonderland type thing in the original series, I think. Was there something like that?
I think that is the planet which makes your fantasies come to life.
So yeah, we'll get to fairy tales soon enough, I'm sure. This was entertaining. The Federation being like that Chakotay, the reason he was shit was the kind of, hang on, so there's going to be a coup on Bajor that's not really part of us. Well, who gives a fuck then? It's like, guy, that's rough. Like, we have to evacuate DS9. Well, I'm not here to analyze the long-term political ramifications. Best just clear off.
Doesn't Chakotay say it's a Prime Directive issue since it's an internal political matter?
Yeah, but isn't the Prime Directive about pre-warp species?
The Prime Directive is whatever the plot needs it to be.
God damn it. That's no way to write legislation. Yeah, protect unprepared civilizations from the danger of starship crews. What the hell other bad Chakotay?
Maybe Bashir should have left a book about gangsters or something on Bajor. Then they'd have to get involved.
Yeah! Oh, God. Right, well, yeah. Damn it. I'm just getting angry about this Chakotay all over again.
It's kind of difficult to talk about because, you know, this is all like, we're not the conclusion, but we're just setting up the third act. So, you know, our villain is revealed. The Cardassians are revealed to have been behind this.
Lee Nalis is given, frankly, nothing to do.
Yeah. I have some issues on it being the Cardassians are secretly orchestrating stuff. But yeah, it's all very Babylon 5, where it's a lot of like space politics going on in meeting rooms.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is that terrible thing where you go, yeah, weird fascist, nationalist, fundamentalists happen just organically. They don't all have to have been manufactured by some evil Machiavellian force, you know? But yeah, even so, still entertaining. So that's episode 2. And finally, on Star Trek Deep Space Nine, we have DS9 Season 2, Episode 3, titled The Siege, aired 10th of October 1993, written by Michael Piller this time and directed by Winrich Kolbe, back from Part 1. The US number one hit, as Marv said, is once again Mariah Carey with Dream Lover. The UK, however, have something slightly different with Take That featuring Lulu and Relight My Fire. I watched the music video for this, and my word, once again, the most 1993 things. I don't know if I've ever paid attention to Robbie Williams as part of Take That, because I was never really a Take That person.
Do you know what's really weird about Take That?
Mm.
It was the big band in the UK, but no one of our generation in the US knows who the fuck Take That is.
That is weird.
It's like with like when the film Lucky Man came out earlier this year. Everyone's like, "Who is this about? Who is Robbie Williams?" I'm like, "He was actually one of the biggest musical artists of the late 90s, early Y2K era."
Yeah. If anyone wants to see some bizarre 90s costume choices, the video for Relight My Fire is certainly a thing. Robbie Williams with a giant hat. It's incredible.
Or, you know, if you want like bizarre 90s costuming decisions, we will have this episode of Star Trek, which we're about to talk about, because our heroes have some stylistic choices.
They do indeed. Speaking of which, Miles, you're recapping the grand finale here. So, Miles, you've got 5 minutes before I lay siege to, my biscuit tin, I guess.
Okay, lay siege. What kind of biscuit tin is it? A Quality Street or just a traditional Bicky tin?
No. This is a nice, it's the shape of those kind of ones, but it's got a big painted butterfly on it. It's the hereditary family one, currently with some custard creams, but they're flavoured with hot cross bun flavoured cream. It's very nice.
So long since I had a custard cream. All right. Okay.
And five minutes starting now.
Sisko is giving a speech to his crew about how they've all made friends or connections with Bajor and the Bajorans, but now he plans to stay and ensure a safe handover of the station. But secretly, it's really to buy time to reveal the conspiracy. It's volunteer only. No one has to stay and risk their lives, since non-Bajorans will be very much not welcome in 5 hours. Especially those with families. Looking at you, Chief O'Brien, who's looking over very shifty right now. The evacuations are going as fast as they can. Too many people will be left behind, and Quark is planning to sell seats. Oh, Quark. You wanker. Jake and Nog share a tearful goodbye as they'll be heading to different evacuation locations. Nog is confident they'll see each other soon, but Jake, not so sure. O'Brien plans to stay on the station despite what his wife Keiko thinks. Keiko wants him to leave, and she is right in most respects. Kira wants to take the proof directly to the council because they can't transmit it. Lee remembers an old base, which may have a working ship. Dax is going to go with Kira since one of her old hosts was a pilot. Sadly, Quark has sold too many seats and has caused a riot at the docking ring. Sisko tries to calm the Bajorans down. He has no hope, but Lee makes a speech that the Bajorans should stay and fight to solve their own problems, and the Federation should and the Federation needs to get away safely. Sisko says goodbye to Jake as his ship finally leaves. Quark is left behind on DS9 since Rom sold his seat to a Dubbo girl. Good thinking, Rom. With only the core cast and Lee Nalis left behind, the Circle fought the Bajoran military Storm Deep Space Nine. It's led by Krim and his second-in-command, Day. Krim doesn't think that Sisko would have given up so easily, especially since he left his baseball behind. Jaro wants to declare victory, but Krim urges caution. Jaro wants Lee alive so he doesn't become a martyr. He and Wynn discuss their ascension, Wynn's ascension to Kai and how they will rebuild Bajor. Kira and Dax find a ship on the old base and a lot of space spiders. The ship is a mess, but they're gonna fly. The power goes out in Deep Space Nine, but Krim is just definitely too set on trying to work out how Sisko is gonna think. In the Jefferies tubes, the crew banter about the quality of the combat rations while Odo watches as a variety of walls to give them, we're in die-hard mode now. A search party is close to finding Bashir and Quark's team, but Bashir's team is able to die-hard their way out of this and capture five of the Bajoran military forces. Meanwhile, Kira and Dax in the fighter come under attack by a Bajoran cruiser. Kira flies the fighter into the atmosphere to give the crews a disadvantage. Lee and O'Brien are pinned down in the security office by Circle forces, and a firefight breaks out on the promenade. Odo turns into a tripwire, aiding the escape. Kira and Dax manage to shoot off one cruiser in Bajor's atmosphere, but a second cruiser forces them to crash. Day, Krim's second-in-command, who was Jack Torrance in the TV miniseries version of The Shining, is trapped in a holo suite. Sisko wants to try and convince him of the Cardassians' role in the coup, but it falls on deaf earrings because Day is definitely in with Jaro. Kira was rooted in the crash and orders Dax to leave her behind, but Dax won't leave her and is able to carry her to the monastery where Beryl is hanging out. Sisko wants Lee to convince Krim that he's on the wrong side. Lee is okay with dying, by the way. Of course, says Sisko, dying just gets you off the hook. Living is harder. The only way for Kira and Dax to get sneak into the Chamber of Ministers is to dress as Vedics. Dax, with a fake nose, is dressed just like she was in Kira's orb vision. Thankfully, Beryl is not naked this time around. Lee confronts Krim in ops and tells him the truth of what's actually going on, and the Cardassians are provoking the coup as an excuse to come back in and take over. Kira and Dax arrive in the Chamber of Ministers and presents her evidence that the Cardassians are planning on using the coup. Wynn looks at the evidence and immediately turns on Jaro, calling that he should be investigated fully. And Jaro's like, yes, of course, I'll let myself be investigated. No one's being very nasty here, and is led off and never seen again. Krim, now knowing the truth, has switch sides and plans to return to Bajor and is going to return Commander Deep Space Nine to Sisko. Day pulls a gun and tries to shoot Sisko, but Lee Nalis jumps and takes a shot and dies, telling Sisko that he's finally off the hook. Kira mourns Lee's death, wondering where they can find...
Time's up!
Yeah, for 5 minutes has died, just like Lee Nalis. But yeah, right, keep going.
Kira mourns Lee's death, wondering where they can find good people like him to unite Bajor. Sisko tells her that he's looking at one right now, and O'Brien still can't equate the Lee Nalis he met with the one Kira and the rest of Bajor spoke of so reverentially. But that's how the history books will remember him. But more importantly, the runabouts are returning with their families, and as life returns to the station, Sisko happily reunites with Jake.
Woo! That's 29 seconds.
Oh, and Quark was there too, but he didn't really do anything of importance.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the things that made me wonder whether or not this was going to be worth doing as like a full... as separate episodes was for Quark subplots, which was like, okay, is this going to be a different thing each time? What's going on? And it's like, no, this is all one one long story.
He's in, you know, we've got Armin Shimerman. He's one of the core cast, so we need to come up with a reason to kind of keep him around, even though he's just there for comic relief.
Yeah.
And doesn't really do much. He's Quark.
Yeah. Yeah, you all know Quark. That guy. Comic relief guy. But yeah, he's... Yeah, actually, the one I was surprised about was the first episode of this, where I was like, oh, is this where we start to get Rom actually trying to unionize, trying to do anything? I said, no.
No.
Not this one. Not yet. Give it time.
Much as we're still kind of on the Pratt version of Bashir, we're still on the... Rom is dumb.
Yeah. Yeah. Something is genuinely up with his brain here. And that said, he did sell out Quark's space to a Darbo girl. So...
Good on Rom.
Yeah, yeah. And this was all right. It was good fun. This will not be the last Die Hard that they do on this station.
Nope. I mean, I feel that this is the weakest episode of the three, because it is mostly... It does kind of feel a bit like fillery, because it's a lot of, okay, we've got to get... We have like one team who are basically just kind of marking time while Kira and Dax do the important mission.
Yeah.
Everything just wraps up really quick.
I guess if they had something to do during it, then it wouldn't feel as bad like that. But when we keep seeing them going, yeah, we're still waiting.
Yeah.
It's like, oh. But, I mean, that said, the Home Alone style shenanigans, the tricks and japes that they pull are still good fun. You know, go, oh, it's a hollow suite, and they're here. No, no, they're not. It's a hollow suite. And, yeah, and Bashir threatening to blow stuff up. It's like, yeah, yeah, okay.
Yep.
That was a moment I could get into it.
Odo being a tripwire.
Yes. Again, fun Home Alone times.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was nice seeing Steven Weber as well, who similarly I recognise from television's The Shining. Stephen King attempting to do The Shining right in his eyes.
Much like this three-parter, I think it would have worked better as a two-parter so they could just condense everything.
Yes. But yeah, it had its moments. It's no Kubrick's The Shining.
Yeah. Again, another bit of, you know, you wouldn't get this in TNG, is the core cast in the Jeffries tubes bitching about combat rations.
Yes.
I liked, you know, O'Brien's like, what are you talking about? Love them. Probably have them all the time, me. And Sisko was like, you know, everyone, you can thank Chief O'Brien, you know, for the food. Again, which is like, a lovely bit of banter, which I don't think you'd get in TNG, because like, those characters are just too perfect to be kind of just jokingly bitching.
Well, Picard would have to be a lot more cutting in his put down of someone in order to do that. But yeah.
Everyone, you can blame the boy for this.
Definitely. Yeah, yeah, because he wouldn't blame LaForge.
No.
So, no, LaForge, you're perfect. It's fine.
It's the boy.
Yes, it's always for boy. I mean, that said, have any of the, aside from O'Brien and Tasha Yar, have any of the TNG lot seen military type combat?
I don't, like, you know, it's that weird kind of spirit, like, nebulous thing where, like, apparently wars with Cardassia were happening, but over there can take care of itself.
It just
seems to be kind of nebulous that, like, you know, I doubt it. You know, Bashir is definitely not in action.
No, God. But yeah, Bashir holds up surprisingly well and seems chipper about the whole thing, really.
Yeah, well, it's all jolly ripping. It's all a jolly ripping yarn for Bashir.
Oh, God. Like, yeah, that's exactly the word I was going to use. He is like, very much the spirit of having some jolly japes and yarns, maybe some ginger beer and ices.
Like, you know that if he had his way and wasn't stuck in the Jeffries tube, he would be wearing a pith helmet.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Because he inevitably has one.
Oh, yeah. He has one just in case.
Yeah. And yeah, we get the closure on Linalis, which feels like after the first episode, it's a bit of a damp squib, but also apparently a very practical factor because they couldn't afford him to come back.
No.
No. Understandably.
Understandably. Meanwhile, Frank Langella apparently worked for Scale, so, you know, and uncredited, so good for him.
Yes, yeah. I think it was his daughter liked it. His kids were Star Trek fans. Yeah, so he didn't want this to be money or exposure. So yeah, that's odd, but yeah, fine.
Yeah,
fair play to him.
Yeah, you know, hey, getting an actor of his caliber to just turn to be in Star Trek, you know, it's a coup. You know, we don't like Star Trek isn't a show where you get like big guest name actors turning up. You do get like odd like appearances here and there.
Well, that's where both Langella and Bamer both do very good work with this material.
Yeah,
you know, like after the first episode of this, Richard Bamer had very little to do aside from hold for fort in episode 2 and then die in episode 3. Even so, he just does some very good performances with it.
Yeah. Like, you get little moments here and there. It's like, you know, I think this is the... Like, I feel at this point Deep Space Nine is still in that kind of TNG Voyager. Everything has... All the toys have to go back in the box correctly at the end of the episode.
Yeah. They've not started experimenting with what they can get away with.
They're not doing, like, the much more serialized long game that Babylon 5 is doing with the same material pretty much by the later points of the first season, definitely by the second. And it's just like, man, you know, you kind of want this to feel to kind of have been spread out as more of a storyline where, like, you know, you have Kira investigating the circle as a subplot and then see Linalis on the station so that when he dies, you feel it would get more of an impact.
Yeah,
not the story, but the characters.
Yeah, I feel like a show that had someone they could afford for a bit and that kind of continuity could have had him around for a little bit. Kind of like, okay, we'll have, you know, one full episode of him being there in a plot and won't see Kira, and then we see Kira at the monastery, and then, you know, build up to con people into thinking, oh, maybe he is about for a bit.
Like, you know, they definitely start getting to it by the later seasons of Deep Space Nine when they have a much more expansive, like, subcast.
Yeah.
Supporting cast. But, yeah, this all feels a bit over too quickly.
So, with that in mind, do you think this could have just been a two-parter? If they'd have trimmed some bits, or...
I said so at first, but then immediately after, I then kind of went back on that decision, because, you know, a lot of stuff does happen in episode 2, and it's just kind of like, where do you cut? Like, because if you cut this one heavily, it would just feel really jammed on. And even though a lot of this is kind of, I don't want to say filler, but it does feel like, you know, it's padding to get the characters to where they have to be.
Yeah, I guess if they figured out how to remove a lot of the waiting or to give them a submission in amongst it, you know? Yeah, like, while we wait, we've got to do this. Oh, this person's been caught, or
a case of, like, we have to keep the station offline so they can't fully gain control of the station and the systems. Like, something like that, or having to potentially sabotage the Federation technology so just in case it goes wrong, the Federation tech doesn't fall into the hands of Bajoran arch-nationalists.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I've no idea if the Circle appear after this. They feel like the kind of thing that could... Unless it is genuinely that, as Jarrow said, he is the Circle.
He is the Circle.
And, yeah.
Like, again, it's like, you know, we know Jarrow doesn't come back. unless Frank Langella was appeared uncredited in another episode, and not even Memory Alpha has it on there. It's just like, okay, so the coup is over. Everything's back to normal.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they do not ever appear again.
Yeah, so I'm assuming that, like, he got found out and died in prison.
Probably, yeah. Yeah, I mean, Wynn, who knows what Wynn would have done.
I think this is one of those cases, you know how we talk about the HBO-ification of Star Trek? It feels like we're kind of looking back on this through 2025 eyes, where we expect we expect more intricate storytelling. And while Deep Space Nine will get there, it's still not there yet. Like, even stuff like the Marquee, when we did that two-parter, I can't remember how big the Marquee, the Marquee, I don't think they're as big as the show kind of wanted it.
Yeah, I don't know. It feels like they're a core element, but that's because they spread over three shows.
Yeah.
Definitely more than the Circle. I'll say that. Yeah, let's see. Again, thrilling radio, I know, as I skim Memory Alpha with all the knowledge of, 62 episodes.
Okay. And, like, you know, I feel like a lot of the stuff they're setting up here, and, you know, with the Bajoran stuff, kind of gets a bit placed by the wayside when the Dominion get introduced, and you have the encroaching threat of the Dominion, and then all the stuff with the Klingons from season 4, and then all the stuff with the Dominion blows up. It feels like, I don't know, the showrunners were just kind of like trying to kind of push, like, hey, we want to have more of a long-term storytelling, but never really knowing what kind of sticks.
I know.
Which is a shame, because like you said, you know, the Bajoran nonsense is interesting, but it feels like they never really know what to do with it.
Yeah. I also don't know if we see the kind of giant spiders again, which that was kind of adorable.
Yeah. Some nice moments with Dax and Kira.
That was fun.
With Dax complaining about everything.
Yes. Yeah, it felt like a nice, almost reversal, where Dax is often the chill one and Kira's the annoyed one.
Mm.
Being able to flip that, and Kira being very much in control of, like, yeah, the old digs. Yeah, giant spider. Used to eat them. It's fine.
Like, it's always fun, like, to see kind of Kira, not Kira, Dax being in that kind of mentor relationship with Sisko, and then she's out with Kira, and she's like, is this dirty? Ew.
Yeah.
You had to fly this with your hands? That's like a baby's toy.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess she's kind of used to slightly better things than that.
Yeah. And I feel Keiko has a point, and is like, you know, O'Brien, you could just leave.
Yeah.
You have family, you can evacuate, but, you know, O'Brien's a core cast member, so he has to stay.
Yeah, it's very nice, but not needed.
Yeah. Especially since O'Brien doesn't do much. Like, again, it kind of goes in that very nebulous, what are they still doing on the station?
I mean, I guess, if not for him, like, who would be able to do all the fun stuff with traps, with engineering things, and joke about rations?
That's kind of true. On the whole, like, I enjoyed a three-parter. It's trying to do something I feel that Deep Space Nine hasn't reached yet. Like, a stuff where, like, there was a military coup, and I don't think, you know, it's ever kind of brought up.
Yeah. All in all, it was a fun time, and doing a three-parter like this, it was quite nice. It will only encourage me to see another three-parter from Enterprise at some point, but that's a future us problem.
Right, so where does this go on the big list?
Good question. Oh, speaking of which, running the numbers, between us, we were 2 minutes and 31 seconds over, which... We've both been more than that on some of these.
So, our big list of currently 162 entries, soon to be 163 entries, of all the episodes of Star Trek we have seen ranked on a big list from best to worst. At spot number one, it is Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, and I don't think... I am still waiting to see what can come close to knocking it off its perch.
Four came close.
Yep. At number 10, we have Darmok at the kind of midpoint at one, I would say at 70. We have the episode of Discovery, Lefe, where Michael Burnham meets Sarek in the Matrix and sees how terrible a father he is. At spot number 100, we have the two-part, the Deep Space Nine two-parter, The Marquis. Going further down at 130, we have Prodigies with Sleeping Borg's Lie, which was a very good Borg episode for the kids show. And at 162, our lowest ranking Star Trek thing ever is Star Trek Section 31.
Yeah, where it belongs. I did manage to do my proper duty and put someone off of watching it in the last week.
Good job.
Yeah, yeah. So, are you a Star Trek fan? Yes. Don't.
I saw it. I actually saw a copy of the Blu-ray in Barnes & Noble. I was like, no.
Yeah, yeah. It's already down to £10 for the Blu-ray in Kex.
Like, I really don't... I hate to use the word content, but the Star Trek Section 31 movie feels like content.
It does, doesn't it? Okay, so let's see. Do we have a good kicking off point for this somewhere?
Like, we don't have very many two-parters on the list yet. We have The Way of the War. We have at number 11. We have Star Trek Deep Space Nine Season 4 Episodes 1 and 2, Way of the Warrior, where Worf joins the show, and we get more Klingon political nonsense, leading off to them becoming the baddies again for a bit.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think it's as good as that by quite a way. Yeah, looking for two-parters, there is Vulcan Hello and Battle at the Binary Stars at 67, which is entertainingly action-packed.
Yeah,
As it says here, we didn't even get to see the Discovery in that, which does feel like a bit of a weird shortcoming. But
at 100, we do have The Marquis, which I feel is a much more uneven story than this.
It is. It is. Yeah, as much as The Marquis will continue to be a factor, it felt like a lot of it was solved by Sisko going, "Oh, you naive children," which, no. No. So, better than that?
Better than that. Okay, so do you think that this three-parter is better than Vulcan Hello and Battle at the Binary Stars?
It's difficult. Because, yeah, again, it's got some lovely action in it and some fun ideas. You know, the Klingon ship where they put their dead in coffins outside as armor is one of the most metal ideas for already one of the most metal species. This is DS9, so there's a bit more preference of more of the cast here than we see in Vulcan Hello and Battle at the Binary Stars, because no one's anyone really
no
yet.
No one's really standing out, apart from Saru.
Mm.
And I feel like, you know, we've definitely, with this, we've gotten over that weird hump every kind of Star Trek first season have, where they're still trying to work out who the characters are, what the show is.
Yeah.
And I feel like we're definitely hitting what Deep Space Nine is going to become, but have not hit it yet.
Yeah, it's definitely getting there. Okay, so better than that. Directly above it, I can see another difficult choice. A piece of the action which we only recently reviewed, and my word, that's a lot of fun.
Oh man, like maybe if they had a bit where Quark was playing Fizbin, maybe get some more hats.
Yeah, more hats, definitely. Oh god, get all of the Vedex dressed as gangsters.
Oh, that'd be great. Or just like have, you know, when O'Brien goes down to the prison planet, with Kira just has, he just replicated himself a ludicrous pimp hat.
Oh God. Yeah, that'd be great. Okay. So I know this one wins out of quantity to piece of the action, but is it a better show, a better episode, and a better Star Trek?
Okay. Let's put it like this.
Mm-hmm. If
I wanted to show someone a story which encapsulates the kind of the political space opera, because like, again, it's like we talked with Unification, which is number 27 on the big list. I feel Deep Space Nine definitely goes more into the kind of the big space opera picture of the push and pull of powerful and not so powerful empires in space, and yeah, the ramifications on a cosmic scale, which while you occasionally have the big galaxy ending threat of, say, the Borg in Next Generation, the Next Generation doesn't really deal in, like, let's say, like, the big picture space opera of, say, like, a Dune or a Foundation or a Babylon 5, where the actions of an entire galaxy revolves around this one location. Like, they do make reference to, like, not wanting the Bajoran, the Cardassians, to get control and thus access to the wormhole, which I feel could have may have been a big kind of a bigger aspect of, you know, like, of wanting to keep the action, wanting to keep Deep Space Nine liberated, or maybe have pulled up, like, more of the religious aspect for the Bajorans.
Yeah.
They want to claim the station because of the wormhole being of huge religious importance. How dare the Federation think they have a claim on it? So, like, if you were showing someone, like, a kind of a storyline of this show, which has the big events and has plenty of action, but still has time for those little character moments, would you go with this or with Way of the Warrior? Because Way of the Warrior has action in spades and does have a, like, I would say, you know, it has a very strong, like, first half of it being mostly character stuff, of having Worf introduced to the crew and having, seeing how Worf doesn't sort of work out his, you know, butting heads with, like, the deep, the much more laid back DS9 cast. And then, like, episode 2 is all, let's just fuck up some Klingons.
Yeah, I mean, I think Way of the Warrior is definitely better for that, because people get the measure of the characters pretty quickly in that. And if they didn't know anything about DS9 at all, going, here's some stuff, follow along with Worf, you'll be as clueless as he is, but like him, you'll learn. And then you'll get to go, I know all of this, I'm invested in these people. Oh my God, all of the action.
I mean, the downside is, you know, you don't get as that, you know, we're not on the Pratt version of Bashir just yet, but we're not on the genetically enhanced know-it-all that we're going to get.
Yeah, but this is an ensemble, so, you know, people are allowed a bit of an off time.
Yeah, and like, I feel like there are this one, like, I love some of the small moments, like, Jake, we didn't mention, like, the Jake and Nog scene at the start of the third episode.
Oh, God, yeah.
Where, you know, you have their friendship. Like, I think that's one of the better scenes of the episode, because you can see how far the characters have come, especially, like, Nog, who I feel is already here, the Nog we're going to get later on, where it's very much kind of earnest, you know, I want to do good. And I value my friendship with the human.
Yeah. So, what do we have here? So, are you saying better than Piece of the Action?
Oh, no.
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 Okay, so...
Like, you know, it's that thing of, it's, you know, everything is on a... We have to rank everything on a big list. And while this is good, and, like, it's good, but not... It's not as great as the show will be later.
Yeah.
It feels more like a trial run for what they're going to be able to do, but they haven't really worked it out yet, especially since a lot of the huge ramifications happen mostly off screen. Like, the coup is thwarted immediately with a bit of evidence being put in Krim is just like, yep, okay, we're done. We're the baddies here. Let's go home.
Yeah, that's how coups happen, right? They just go, oh, well, we've had a lot of fun. And now we'd best call it a day. You know, our one person in charge is arrested. So, bye.
Yeah. Meanwhile, you know, also Krim is just like, oh, yes, I understand, Sisko. He and I, Krim is much like Kor from the original show, where he clearly wants to be like Sisko's one rival. But Goldicott's just like, I'm right here. I'm right here.
Yeah.
And I was expecting more Gold Dukat.
Yeah. Yeah. He was only briefly in it. But yeah, he, as ever, always good fun.
And I feel like the whole Cardassian aspect made the resolution a bit too easy.
Yes. I feel like put this a few seasons later and maybe they wouldn't have done that.
Because it just, yeah, because there's like, oh, the Cardassians were secretly manipulating events in this country to give them favorable means. That means they go, okay, that, yep, our bad, slap on the hand, let's go home.
I mean, the generous read is that this was happening anyway, but it wouldn't have been armed without the Cardassians.
Yeah.
Who saw an opportunity to go, well, they're not in the best state, but we don't need that. We just need some quick overthrowing, and then we'll take.
And it's not as if the coup is really happening on Deep Space Nine, because it's primarily a military, with Day being a Circle operative.
Mm.
So it just kind of feels all very neat, or a bit too neat.
Definitely. Yeah.
Again,
okay, so
you can tell this was made in America before 2001.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that is a theme that keeps popping up with this sort of thing.
So, what do you think?
So, I think as much as a piece of the action felt like, oh yeah, they've got access to a gangster set and they're just going to have some fun with that, it's still a good episode of Star Trek. Like, yes, it looks like a gangster thing, but they do a Star Trek in it. And yeah, I think you were saying above Vulcan, hello, battle at binary stars. So if we go between the two, that puts this at the new 67.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So, Miles, share with everyone what the decision is on next episode.
We are doing Space Babies!
Space Babies.
To quote that one episode of Doctor Who when the word Space Babies is used ad nauseum.
So many times. Yes. Yeah, we knew that at some point weird space pregnancy was gonna happen.
Like, it was only going to be a question of which one we do first, weird space pregnancies or time Star Trek has clearly done a racist.
Yeah, we were aiming for a bottom shooter and we still don't have the stamina to deal with the Star Trek does a racism.
We don't have the lobes to deal with either Star Trek does a racism or Quark has a sex change.
Exactly, exactly. So you guys are getting space pregnant.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Because we really don't want to have to talk about time Star Trek does a weird gender thing.
Yeah. Okay. So you can catch that in a fortnight's time, and you can catch us on Blue Sky at casualtrek.bsky.social. You can also throw us a couple of bars of gold press latinum by going to ko-fi.com/casualtrek if you want us to make an episode around a specific theme, idea, character, or just suggest one episode and we'll build a full casual trek out.
Go avant-garde, suggest color.
Yeah, I'd be interested in trying that out.
Yeah,
cool. And where can the folks find you, Miles?
They can find me on my B-Sky at milesreedlabato.bsky.social. Although I'm trying to limit my time on social media these days for the sake of my health. Or you can find me on my blog at mareedlabato.wordpress.com.
And you can find me on skyshark.bsky.social for Blue Sky. And Faked Tales for my own writing about 2000 AD and such. and Who Dares Rolls, where I am mostly writing about RPGs. And I don't know, maybe when this airs, I'll have just come back from UK Games Expo. So I will be talking about board games and things that I've seen there on the Who Dares Rolls, probably within a few days of this episode coming out. So yeah, that's it for us.
You know, do a Starfleet, have a jelly baby, don't get manipulated by outside factions into cynical manipulations of your own political ideas.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, no fascist uprisings.
Yes, please.
Yeah, our audience is frankly small, so we can't have any of you doing that. We'd feel bad.
Even you, Sean.
Yeah, Sean.
You have been listening to Casual Trek, a Nerd and Tie podcast, presented by Charlie Etheridge Nunn and Miles Reed Lobato. Music by Alfred Etheridge Nunn. Edited by the hosts and by Rihanna Reed Lobato. Star Trek is owned by Paramount. Not us. Not yet.